Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 15th, 2018, the House Speaker John Lewis edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C., and you know who's with me? Guess who? It's John Dickerson. John of CBS This Morning. Why are you down here? It's so nice.
I'm so happy to be with you. I'm down here to interview Cindy McCain. That's the first time she's been interviewed since Senator McCain died. So I'm going to rush off after I'm with you two and go talk to her.
That is great. Well, it's lovely to see you. You look good. You seem in the pink. I'm glad to see all those months away in New York. You haven't lost weight. You have good color.
That's good. I'm
glad. No wasting diseases. Your teeth are straight. It's good. Emily Bazelon is in New Haven, the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Hello. I'm enjoying your reunion, even though I'm not there for it.
On this week's show, it was a blue wave. We will talk about why the last week of election results have cheered Democrats, and also how the recounts in Florida are turning into a referendum on democratic elections, trust in democratic elections, faith in democracy. Then, will Nancy Pelosi be Speaker of the House? Will House Democrats impeach President Trump? The two big questions facing the new Democratic majority in the House. We will grapple with both of them. And then the crazy saga of Matt Whitaker, the sort of maybe possibly Attorney General of the United States. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And before we go any further, reminder, on December 12th at NYU's Skirball Center in Manhattan, we will have our annual conundrum show. Simon Doonan will be our guest for some of the show, and we are going to grapple with amazing conundrums. You should please send us some more. We've gotten some great ones from you. But please tweet at us at SlateGabFest with your great ideas. Here are a couple that I like that we've gotten in so far. If you could move the holidays on the calendar, how would you rearrange them? For example, would you move Thanksgiving to March? There's less of a pileup. Another one from another listener was, if you could only eat one color of food for the rest of your life, what color would you choose? Which is that's a tough one. Anyway, those and even deeper issues, please send them to us at Slate Gabfest or email us at gabfest@slate.com if you don't want to do it publicly. And please come to the show. You can still get tickets at slate.com/live. It's a joyful, delightful, fun evening. Please join us December 12th. We're 9 days past the midterm elections. Not everything is settled. First of all, the early results, the results that people on the East Coast watching on election night saw were a little bit misleading, because data now suggests that Democrats had a much better night than it felt like early in the evening, that their Democratic triumph was perhaps as vast as the Republican triumph was in 2010. Democrats captured hundreds of state legislative seats, perhaps 35, maybe even more House seats, six governorships, I think. And they pounded Republicans in several key states that will be important in the 2020 presidential election. But there's one big, big question mark out there. Florida, dear Florida, has three recounts going now. There are three close races, two important ones as far as we're concerned. The governor's race between Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum, Republican first, Democrat second there, and the much closer Senate race between Nelson and Scott for Bill Nelson and Rick Scott for Senate. So, Emily, what is going on with those recounts now? And is this a useful exercise? Is it important that this happen? It does seem like, you know, we're 10 days gone. What's up, man?
Really? I mean, it seems to me like it's important.
I'm just trying to create tension.
It's all right. Well, you did. You got me to react. I mean, look, first of all, we got to count all the votes. Second of all, Florida has a law that if the election is within half a point, there's an automatic recount. Seems pretty sensible to me. I mean, you're just trying to make sure that the will of the people actually materializes in the election results. That, of course, is the sort of, you know, blue sky version of this. There are also things going on the ground in Florida, you know, like a box of ballots in a high school cafeteria somewhere, these sort of questions about how competent and sure-footed election officials are being or have been along the way. And I understand why, you know, people get worked up about those things in both parties. But the notion that there's something wrong with having a recount and that 10 days out from an election, it's like an outrage that we don't know the winner. I mean, that's just like the administrative election process working itself out.
Well, you've had this situation where Republicans, some of them, most notably and importantly, the president, have basically made recount equal, or tried to, I should say, make recount equal theft of the ballot which is, you know, an amazing thing when we think about just yet another norm that's being shredded, that the president is reaching down into Florida and not, you know, saying one of 100 other things he could say, but he's saying essentially that there is fraud going on. That's really amazing. So then you have this complicating problem, which, as Emily said, this recount is all, you know, mandated and by law. But then you have Brenda Snipes in Broward County, where even the Sun Sentinel says, no, we don't think that she stole anything. It's just that she's incompetent. And there are these stories of incompetence that have been associated with her office, which muddies the picture.
What's interesting, right. John, you're, of course, a historian of this stuff. It, to me, is that actually, really, until quite recently, until practically our own lifetimes, elections were filled with a huge amounts of fraud and chicanery and post-election, you know, finding of ballots and manipulation, especially in certain cities with strong political machines. And so it's not as though people's sense that this could be tampered with is misguided. I think it's not the case that they are, but it is, because even within the lifetime of Donald Trump, this has really happened at a significant level.
Yeah, sure. I mean, people assume that John Kennedy was basically elected president through fraud. So, you know, some of the biggest there are big examples of this. But that's why I think Emily's point, which is that there is a system in place actually for working through this. And that's why, given the existing possible suspicion, it seems to me that as a public official, your job is not to add to the suspicion. Is because of the, you know, you're basically fanning the flames.
What frustrates me is that every election we encounter the flaws and weaknesses of our system, which is actually thousands of different county systems. We have no centralized method of ballot counting, no agreed upon methods for even designing a ballot, as we're seeing again in Florida, where the Broward County ballot may have disadvantaged Democratic Senate candidate Bill Nelson. So there, every time we hear about all these problems, there's wringing of hands, you know, old ballot machines, like county officials who don't know what they're doing. And then instead of having a kind of rigorous scrutiny, a review that might yield to a better system, we're having from President Trump in particular, but also some Republican candidates, both Rick Scott in Florida and a couple of Republicans in Orange County, Florida, have picked up this idea that there is fraud, that, you know, the Democrats are cheating and stealing the election. And to make those accusations with no basis is scary. Like, it's the shredding of a norm that has kept the country, has allowed for a peaceful transition of power in all the times that we've had a country. Like, it is actually the most foundational thing about democracy, that you acknowledge that someone else won an election and you hand over the reins of power to them. And I really wonder what this augurs for 2020 if we see close elections that year, especially involving Trump himself.
One quick little wrinkle we should mention: on Thursday, a judge in Florida announced that the state has to give voters whose mismatched signatures disqualified their ballots until Saturday at 5 to correct those signature problems. So this is a part of the law that requires people who vote by mail to sign their ballot. And if that signature doesn't match the one they first used when they registered, then the vote doesn't count. So this is, I think, the portion that some Republicans, I think including Marco Rubio, has said is they're changing the rules after the fact, right? So the original rule was the signatures have to match. Now Democrats are asking for the rules to be changed.
Yeah,
whether
but the
you
rule
buy that argument
that you can
or not.
Right, but the rule is you can go to court and challenge what looks like throwing out a ballot for no reason. It's not changing the rules. It's using our system to try to get a ruling from a judge to preserve valid ballots, which could be Republican or Democratic ballots.
So the judge has just ruled that people can go solve that problem if that was what invalidated their vote. So that's one of the ways that Nelson, who is, I think, what, 13,000 votes behind Scott, mm-hmm. that was one of the ways in which he might close that gap. But whether or not this has – whatever the practical effect of it is, the fact that the judge has now ruled, you know, sort of in Nelson's favor will likely set off a whole new round of what you were describing previously in terms of Republicans using this to say you're changing the rules after the game.
A couple of small points on some things that you've said. One, it is very interesting that signatures are still so important,
yeah.
because as
yes.
somebody – I think I was listening to this and maybe on the Daily yesterday, that people's signatures have people no longer have stable signatures. Young people in particular use handwriting so little, and they have to sign so rarely, that they don't have a stable signature in the way that you had to a generation ago.
I don't really have a stable signature. I don't know about you guys. Like, I actually find it hard to do it the same way every time. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. No, mine is decaying also. Especially, I mean, the credit card signature is nonsense.
By the way, the credit card companies have basically given up on the signature nonsense.
The other point is, Emily, I would dispute your notion that the Broward County ballot disadvantaged Nelson. The Broward County ballot didn't disadvantage Nelson. It just disadvantaged people seeing the Senate vote. And it happened because Broward County is Democratic, that Nelson was the person hurt. So it wasn't
true.
It wasn't designed to hurt Nelson. It was just designed poorly such that the Senate was less visible, which is, I think, is an important distinction.
Yes, it had the effect of disadvantaging Nelson. True.
And the effect, by the way, right, is that it's 25,000 fewer votes cast in the Senate race than in any other race, right? That's the disadvantage.
Than in the governor's race.
Than in any other race.
In a very Democratic district.
Yes.
Right, right.
John, I want to go back to the 2000 election because, of course, the recount drama occupied the nation in a much grander way. It was much more important. Much bigger things were at stake. One thing that I think is a distinction, and maybe I'm wrong, is that in 2000, it was certainly Republicans were very aggressive about fighting for George Bush's victory and for making sure that the recount happened in the way that they wanted it to happen. There was not this undercurrent of fraud as a claim, was it?
The Brooks Brothers riot is about the Republican staffers rioting at the.
But it was about how they were. It wasn't that there was voting fraud.
Well, yeah, but they were. But the fraud was. Sorry.
Okay. No, you go ahead.
It's all related.
No,
but John's right.
My recollection is that they were saying that they're stealing the election in the how they were counting. I mean, there are two. It was a little bit fuzzy here, but I think there were at least two arguments. One was, don't count the hanging chads. You can't possibly determine some of the chads weren't fully punched. That's a kind of that's about just the form of the ballot. And then then the Brooks Brothers riot, I think, which was when Republican staffers from Washington, many of whom wore their Brooks Brothers shirts because they
including,
were watching.
I think Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh
yes,
was there.
He was there.
I think you're right.
Yes.
And they were imports from Washington trying to look like locals. Were arguing that fraud was taking place. And just quickly, while we're here, the norm's changing. The Gore staffers, who basically did the same thing, which is everybody flocked to Florida, but the Gore staffers took off their campaign pins because there was a norm against looking like you were trying to fight out the campaign in this judicial or this kind of official proceeding. Now that's completely gone. Even the pretense that this is not a totally partisan fight, nobody's even keeping that pretense anymore at this part. And I think that's a result of the fact that Democrats feel like Republicans always treated the Florida recount in 2000 as a partisan fight to the death, and that they, Democrats, were naive about the trust in the system.
Emily, everyone in America on both sides likes to win an election. Republicans like to get lots of votes and win. Democrats like to get lots of votes and win. Libertarians like to get enough votes to spoil things. Everyone enjoys casting a ballot. And so do you think that the effort, which is in this case on behalf of Republicans in Florida, is an effort to fundamentally undermine the notion of democracy? Or do you just think it has the side effect of undermining democracy because it goes after these institutions, but that's not really its intent?
I mean, I think it's the intent is self-interested. Rick Scott wants to be seated in the Senate, and he wants to make sure that if this count flips, that there's a lot of questions about that and that he can go back in and try to reverse it yet again. What is shocking to me is how little regard there are for the collateral effects of this, right? Like, let's imagine that Scott does not actually want to undermine American democracy. He is a patriot, likes this country just like the rest of us. He's willing to kind of play with fire. And of course, President Trump is willing to do that too. And there's just this heedlessness about what the consequences and potential ripple effects of these kinds of baseless accusations are. And if they start to become the norm, then you just wonder, like, if that's going to add this whole other element to American elections, like the apathy that people feel about the democracy, too, can come into play. This kind of hopelessness, like this is an unfair, rigged system from beginning to end. And all of that's really dangerous. But and yet, like, the warning signs that political scientists put out again and again about how this is corrosive just get swept away by Republicans.
And we should note that the Department of Law Enforcement and the Division of Elections in Florida have both found no evidence that ballots were being, you know, that there's fraud and that ballots are being pulled out of, you know, closets in which they were hidden. And Scott controls as governor, has control over those. It's also amazing, by the way, just in another norm that's or another part of our political world, right? Pam Bondi, the attorney general of Florida, criticized the Department of Law Enforcement. And some people saw that as an attempt to basically audition to the president for the attorney general's job or some other job in the administration.
I'll criticize the law enforcement I'm associated with.
Right. Yeah. And yes. So you have this weird – so it's just a way in which norm breaking – president broke a norm by reaching down into the Florida race and claiming something for which there is no evidence. And then to seek to get a job with that president, you affirm his broken norm. Yep. And that's the way adhesion for partisan and political purposes and ambition purposes – shifts the entire institutional norm structure, because now you have an attorney general of the state criticizing a division of the state without, as far as I've seen in anything I've read, any evidence. And it just when we think about what norm breaking does at the presidential level, because of the adhesion of partisanship, it shifts entire institutions over to his new position.
I want to grapple with one other small thing, and then actually I want to talk about this blue wave question. So to me, Emily, the worst of the worst election manipulation or the worst shadow on the election actually is not in Florida. It continues to be what happened in Georgia, where Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, oversaw a campaign to limit voter registration, strike people from the rolls in the years leading up to his own race for governor, which he then won very narrowly, again, continuing as Secretary of State to oversee the whole election process up until the election. That, to me, is the worst of those. And that Florida seems to me to be relatively small beer compared to what Kemp did.
Yeah, I mean, what you see with Kemp is a kind of stranglehold on the registration process that disadvantaged Democrats and disadvantaged Stacey Abrams, who before she ran for governor was trying to sign more people up to vote. And, you know, the end game here is that in a state that is changing, that has more people of color, that has more people who would presumably vote Democratic, you kind of calcify the electoral composition of that state. You keep the old guard in power, who happen to be white Republicans, by making it hard for other people to vote. And I think that is absolutely what we're seeing in Georgia. You know, Stacey Abrams is, I think, still trying to get a runoff against Kemp, because if Kemp doesn't have above 50% of the vote, there's an automatic runoff election in Georgia. But if she doesn't make that threshold, it is going to be hard to think it was not affected by these hundreds of thousands of registrations that were thrown out.
Is there any bigger gap in or bigger discordance in a title as Secretary of State? That the Secretary of State at a state and the Secretary of State of the country, like, they have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah,
it's so confusing.
It's
whenever
true.
I hear Secretary of State in a state is like, you know, the administrator, and then Secretary of State for the country. John is like, why?
No, but I think
like, why is Plots
why
Andy Rooney?
No.
But I feel like Andy Rooney moment of significance, because like, if you have it's hard enough to keep straight what all these government officials do. If you have this confusion built in, it makes it harder for people to understand what this office is and why they should care about it locally. Yeah.
Which they should. All right, John. Last question, which is not really this topic, but let's throw towards it too. Was this a much more successful election for Democrats than people thought, at least at the beginning of Tuesday night?
Yeah, and I think for the reasons you mentioned, there was a split decision, though, as we talked about last week. Immediately upon saying that, is because there were these structural issues in the Senate races. I think there was also some overexcitement about the idea that Democrats might take back the Senate, which was always a super, super, super long shot for all of the structural reasons that we're now talking about. So I think that might have been part of it. But in the end, those California results, the fact that, according to David Wasserman at the Cook Political Report, the Democrats won the popular House vote by about 7 points. The total number in the House, I think, of Democratic pickups is going to be closer to 40, which means that that it is the third largest gain in the last 40 years after 2010 and 1994. Now, why does this all matter? Well, it matters because it's our best actual temperature taking of the mood of the country. It's not polling, it's not hot takes on Twitter, and it's not punditry. It's actual human beings doing what is necessary. And it ratifies to me all the previous work, which is to say, when you go and ask somebody to write a check, they're like, my money's going out in the wind. They convinced Democratic donors, and for the final quarter in the race, 112 Democrats in competitive Republican seats outraised their opponents. That then led to these pickups. So that you now, as a Democrat, if you're thinking about how do we run for 2020, you now have data that says, hey, if you organize, if you go out and you sign people up, separating apart Emily's point about Georgia, it will lead to this result. That's really strong medicine for going out and making the next set of appeals to voters. It also, you know, when we talk about the leadership race, which we will in a minute, Republicans went back to the playbook and tried to demonize Democrats by tying them to Nancy Pelosi. Well, that didn't work in a lot of these districts that were more moderate districts or swingy-ish or battleground districts, and where you might imagine that working more than, say, a deep blue district. So the nature and size of the victory is really the most important for the people who are planning the next race. It's not just a kind of semantic debate about what's a wave and what's not a wave.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts. And today's Slate Plus segment, we're going to talk about the centennial of the end of World War I, 100 years since the armistice, probably the most pointless war ever fought, the worst war ever fought, the greatest waste in human history, arguably. Go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. House Democrats, now a rampant majority, face two big decisions in the coming months. First, they must choose the speaker. Well, I guess the whole House must choose the speaker, but Democrats will drive that. Will they once again choose Nancy Pelosi to lead the House? Second, will they seek to impeach President Trump? Both of these questions were campaign issues. As many as two dozen Democrats now in the House, many of them newly elected, said or indicated while campaigning that they would not support Pelosi for speaker. That is a problem given that their majority is only, 18 or so. Similarly, Tom Steyer gave a lot of money to some of these new House members as part of his need to impeach campaign. And now some of them, and perhaps a majority of Democratic voters, feel a need to impeach, feel a longing to impeach. So let's take each of these two questions. John, let's start with the Pelosi. It is weird to me that Nancy Pelosi, who was an incredibly effective legislator, who is obviously a very, very brilliant politician, great leader of the Democrats for many years. Now, she has been there a long time. You could argue she's been there too long. But that essentially a campaign ginned up by Republicans who don't like her would cause Democrats to abandon her.
Well, I don't think that's the only reason they want to abandon her. And in fact, it gets at the tension, I think, in some of the anti-Pelosi things. I mean, my baseline position, I have two strong positions going into this. One is you can't beat something with nothing. And there is no, this used to happen in the races against John Boehner, which is that restive Republicans would say, we got to get rid of John Boehner as speaker. And then there was never any alternative to John Boehner who could get more than a handful of votes. Now, that didn't remove the pressure in the system that ultimately bounced Boehner from office. That's the first thing. Second thing is lots and lots of rules of politics are totally being rewritten right now. And so that first thing I said has some stuff in it that may no longer be the case anymore and may no longer be true, which is what makes politics so exciting and so cool and so and requires really keeping the eye on the ball. And so you have a new, you know, those new members we talked about who are coming into the Democratic conference are energized, and they are the future of the Democratic Party, and they ran outside, in some cases, the system. And so all of that energy has to have somewhere to go. And so, but I still sort of believe in the first will end up ruling in the end here. But on this question of whether Pelosi is a, on the one hand, people are arguing, look, we need younger faces in leadership. We need something that suggests the next generation. And then there's this argument that she's going to, you know, Republicans are going to use her against them. I just don't. I think that they proved that the attacks on Nancy Pelosi are not effective. And I think then we should, and I'll shut up and you guys can answer this. What do Democrats want their speaker to do in this? And one thing I would just point out is she is now the leader of the Democratic Party. Until there's a Democratic nominee, she is the leader of the Democratic Party. So what exactly does one, what would a Democrat in, with interest of the party, what would they want her to do or want the speaker to do?
Is it about what they want her to do, or is it more have to do with the optics, like the fact
right.
that she, That's, as
yeah.
a leader, right? Like as the leader of the Democratic Party, it's her face. She's been so pilloried. She's been seen as a liability. I mean, I think if they accept what you just said, John, that the attacks on her aren't effective, then a lot of the argument against her goes away, except for this thing of like, well, she's been there forever. We should just have someone new already. That's, you know, that's what I am hearing from them is this idea of new voices, which is sort of content free, right? It has more to do with like style than substance.
Well, there's this other problem, which is that there's a bunch of people who made commitments who said during the campaign that they wouldn't support her for speaker.
Yes.
Enough of them that if they actually live up to those commitments, she might not be able to be speaker. So I think, you know, in the cynical, pragmatic world that I want to live in, those people would be like, all right, you know, you'd let as many of those people out of their promise as possible. You'd allow some of them to stick to it, and you'd make sure you had 218, you know, where five of them are going to abandon it, and those five are in relatively safe Democratic seats. I assume that's what will happen.
I think that's exactly right. One of the first tests of Nancy Pelosi's leadership will be to rescue new members from their promises by allowing them to vote against her. And this is one of the all great House leaders know how to do this, which is to make sure you're going to win and then give everybody who needs to vote against you, you know, this is vote no, but hope yes, right? And that's so she will be helping out using her skills and her knowledge of the way these things work, the very people who pledged and were elected on the idea that they would kick her out. And that's why I asked, what do you want her to do? Because, yes, she's the face of the Democratic Party until there's a nominee. But then she also, if you believe that one of the ways that Democrats are going to should most beneficially spend their next 2 years is to be heavy on policy and to really go at the president where he is weakest, to the extent that you believe that healthcare helped Democrats in this last race. And this, again, goes at this question of blue wave. If you believe there was a blue wave and it was created in part by a focus on healthcare, then you could argue that's the way the Democrats should spend the next year and a half. And if that's so, then she, as a tactician in the House, would know how to use the process, which gets covered by the news media and also has obviously some real stuff to it. I mean, it is the functioning of one branch of Congress. Use the process to best effect to keep teeing up those essential policy questions if you believe this idea that Democrats need one of the ways to revive the party is to be a heavily policy-oriented party.
I believe that. Emily.
So if you were a Democratic strategist and you could just wave a magic wand, right, like all of the messiness of a big fight, you just forget about Pelosi's power for a moment – what would you want? Would you want her to stay? Do you think that's the most effective way forward for the Democrats? Or would you want to, you know, end her time at the head of the party and like bring in a younger, fresher, less vilified face?
Well, John will have a better answer to this. My answer would be probably you do want her there because she is she's their smartest tactician. She has a great record as a legislator and she's a great member of the House and a great leader of the Democrats. But I don't know that you want Hoyer and Clyburn, who are the 2 and 3 right now. And you want to make really damn sure that you are training up your new executive team, your grooming new executive team, so that in 2 years, in 4 years, you have a significant turnover of that, because the problem is not the, as John said, you can't be something with nothing. And right now there isn't a credible younger generation set of leaders. There just doesn't exist. And so they need a little bit of time to get there. And during that time, I think you do want Pelosi being the master strategist and leader. Okay. John's not going to add anything to that.
No, I think that, I mean, I think that's, I think you're generally right, and I think, I would just kind of repeat what you said.
So. Okay. Before we leave Pelosi and move on to impeachment, I just want to repeat this idea that Ryan Grimm, a Washington journalist, circulated on Twitter. I don't know if it's his idea. I saw it that way. Bridget, our researcher, pointed out to me, which is that one thing that Democrats could do is to make John Lewis speaker and have Pelosi be majority leader. And then have a transition plan. John Lewis, of course, is also very old. I mean, he's probably 80 as well. But John Lewis is one, you know, arguably the greatest living American, one of the handful of the greatest living Americans, hero of the civil rights movement, been a very stalwart member of Congress for many years. I don't know that he's a great member of Congress. I actually haven't followed his legislative record. I have no idea if he'd be a decent House Speaker, but he has like a symbolic weight and heft. And I just nod my head in the direction of that sentimental idea, because John Lewis deserves all accolades and honors.
Well, it is. I mean, there is an interesting notion here that you could have Pelosi in her tactician role, but in the number two slot, and just divide up the duties differently, right? So that you think of the person who's at the forefront as the face you want, like the person you want on television the most.
I don't think that this is too clever. I think no. I mean, again, it depends on what you want the speaker at the end of the day to have done. And I don't think, by the way, either Lewis or Pelosi are the television person you want for the party. If you are a Democrat and you buy the idea that the energy, the quote-unquote television energy or optics energy of the party needs to be what people were talking about in the wake of this election, which is, almost 40 new people, lots of them new and interesting and veterans and Democratic fighter pilots and people of color and different orientations and just the kind of vibrant future of America image that a lot of Democrats want to portray. That's the optic you want. And then I think the speaker has to be the speaker. And so I don't think you can split it and kind of have somebody behind the scenes doing the tactical work, because a lot of this stuff happens in the moment. And so the speaker can't say, hold on, I got to go call the person who's in charge of tactics here.
Right. But also the optics of, imagine if it's a man or a white man who you'd give that to, like, oh, we're going to have Nancy Pelosi do all the work while this symbolic white guy gets the credit for it.
And not, she wouldn't stand for that.
That
either.
Does not seem like a good look. All right. Let's move on to impeachment. The other big question that Democrats are going to face. So Tom Steyer, this Democratic donor, had the need to impeach PAC, I think, and funneled a lot of money to Democratic campaigns. According to some surveys, a majority of Democratic voters would like the House to consider impeachment. Seems to me like a catastrophically stupid plan to go in with the idea that you're going to impeach. Not to say that if the Mueller report doesn't show something dire or something, amazing comes out from various investigations, that impeachment isn't something that you'd have to consider as an obligation. But to have impeachment be your first plan of attack seems to me unbelievably stupid. Emily, do you think what's the case, if you would care to characterize it, maybe you won't, for impeachment to be an arrow in the quiver from the beginning?
I mean, I'm just completely agree with you that this is a terrible idea, thus resistant to making the case. What is the case? The Democrats have been yelling and screaming about this for 2 years. Now they're in power. The president is like a clear and present danger to the nation, and we have to address this right away. I think the politics of it are bad for the Democrats. But I also think on the substance, you know, Trump was elected to office. And until we hear the results of the Mueller investigation and really understand the role he played, if any, in obstruction of justice or helping the Russians mess around with the election, whatever it was, I want those facts to be out there before I try to decide whether I think Trump should be impeached. And if for my elected officials, I feel like the responsibility is even higher to just be kind of sober here and proceed with caution.
You both, of course, are making the correct points. I think also once you get down, once you start down the road for impeachment, the reason it should be an open and shut case and obvious to everyone is that, well, A, that makes it easier, but B, once this thing gets started, a lot of stuff gets released into the atmosphere and people freelance and behave in all kinds of unpredictable ways. And your party gets defined by the insanity that ensues when you're in a really cut and thrust where it's not an open and closed, open and shut case. I think Republicans believe this is what happened with the Clinton impeachment. Although there's a really interesting investigation of the Clinton impeachment in The Atlantic, in which Bob Bennett, the president's former lawyer, basically muses out loud in a way that has been on this show and lots of other places, which was what would happen today if to a president, Bill Clinton, if impeachment was raised, given the evolution in the way people think about accusers and the accused. Anyway, so it creates a completely unpredictable environment, and people who think about impeachment have this kind of antiseptic, it feels like. The argument relies on an antiseptic impeachment proceeding, and I think that's completely impossible.
Emily, to me, the big strategic question is not really impeachment or not impeachment, because I assume that whoever the Democratic leader is going to tamp down the impeachment. There's not a majority to push for impeachment promptly within the Democratic caucus. But to me, the real question is policy or investigations, and what's the balance and what's the kind of metaphorical weight that you give to each of those. And I think the case for a strong policy focus, for passing a minimum wage bill, for focusing on healthcare, is that A, the president's not very good at those issues. B, it shows what the Democratic Party stands for. It is C, it's your actual freaking job is to legislate. And the public seems to desire that, and also that Democrats are relatively good at that compared to some of the political fighting, which they seem not so good at. The case for the investigations are that this is an incredibly corrupt administration. The president himself has, whether through the emoluments clause or just general misbehavior or the Russia stuff, has committed gross acts, and his cabinet has committed gross acts, and there is rampant corruption that needs to, and the government needs to restrain that. Which should the Democrats do? I mean, and you can't say, I mean, obviously they're going to choose both, but which one should they aspire to do more?
I mean, you convinced me last week or the week before that policy should come first. And I was excited about the idea that the first bill they might introduce is about voting rights, about automatic voter registration and addressing the Supreme Court's decision that weakened the Voting Rights Act, that decision in Shelby County versus Holder. Like, they had a bunch of ideas for strengthening the democratic process. Now, maybe that's like wonkier than a lot of other people would go for, but healthcare is another really obvious one. That's what they campaigned on. And I just feel like it's so crucial to remind voters how you can affect people's day-to-day lives when Washington can seem abstract and far away and super frustrating. So that seems to me like it should be their priority, even though they're always going to say both and when you ask this question right about policy versus investigations. But there is a decision to make about what gets the most oxygen and attention.
I mean, it just seems to me that it's that the for any party, the clearest way once you get power to behave. And this is why I'm just a person with hot takes and not actually in power. But is to do things that are to use your investigative power and the powers you've been given to tee up issues that are on your territory. So, I mean, this is what President Trump does with his, you know, the talk about the caravan and birthright citizenship. He gets in fights about policy issues that he thinks are important, but that keep the fights, the debates, on his turf. And so I would think there's a whole range of policy issues I think that's even closer to what I'm talking about than, say, something like the endless Benghazi hearings, which I think were ultimately a political mistake for Republicans.
John, how will Democrats grapple with the fact that, you know, their $15 minimum wage bill is going to go nowhere? That is not going to become law. The Senate won't take it up. It will never become law. And so the press will cover it, you know, the day the bill is passed. There'll be like, you know, House passes minimum wage law, that's going nowhere. But any investigation, any of the Trump tweeting about the investigation is going to be top of CNN,
well, I
top
think,
of, you know, Fox, top of MSNBC, and it's going to be the,
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the most clever political tacticians in either party figure out how to harness the rage or the whatever, or the worst instincts of the media that cover them, to harness those for issues that they think are important. Whether people like it or not, President Trump has found a way to do this. It's part of the fact that he's actually the president of the United States and he can send troops to the border, and he's perfectly happy to have a battle over whether the troops are really worthwhile being sent there. By the way, there seems to have been a slight change in Defense Secretary Mattis's way he's articulated what the troops are doing there. He now talks about it as training, which is worth watching.
Why is that worth watching?
Well, because originally he said they were there to meet an actual need. I mean, that in other words, the danger from the caravan was such that these reinforcements were required. If it's training, then that's a secondary. That's not the first reason everybody was also
might not be a good reason to keep them there over Thanksgiving.
Right, right. It seems to me that it's always the smart political thing to do is to have substantive fights over things that are on the territory you want them to be on. And I don't know how they solve that, but that's how smart people, you know, achieve their greatness, is to find a way to tee those questions up in the environment we've got at the moment.
Emily, do you have a take on how Democrats can do that?
No, not really. I'll be interested in watching them try. I mean, look, the media has a role to play here. Not that we'll do it right, or at least, like, not that cable news will do it right. But, you know, the media could send different signals.
Also, I wonder if, again, this goes back to whether a blue wave happened or not in the substantive sense, not the semantic sense, which is, if it's true that all of the discussion about healthcare, which happened largely under the radar of the freak show, was effective, then perhaps they don't need to do what you said, which is, you know, let the freak show continue. I think because you're in charge, you get you might get stained by the freak show more because you're in charge of the House than you would have pre-takeover of the House. But, you know, if it's true that the focus on healthcare ended up energizing and winning over hearts and minds, then maybe there can be a disconnect. You can narrow cast just to your voters.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Attorney General Matt Whitaker, or is he Attorney General Matt Whitaker, is under fire this week. Whitaker has been appointed, perhaps, maybe, sort of.
No, he was definitely appointed. There's a lawsuit about whether he should remain there, but he is definitely there. Like, if you go to the office of the Attorney General today, he will greet you at the door.
Do you really think he's in the office already?
That's part of his job.
I remember being at Maine Justice. That was a good office.
Yeah, he opens the door for everyone. That's what he does. No, he's there.
Well, he was appointed to temporarily succeed fire Jeff Sessions at DOJ.
He is the acting Attorney General of the United States.
Is he allowed to do the job? Emily, fill in all the bright colors with your crayons. What is the case that he is the Attorney General? What is the case that he is not the Attorney General?
The case that he is the Attorney General is that Trump has both the statutory and constitutional prerogative to fill this job with someone who is not confirmed by the Senate for up to 210 days. That's the statutory limit. And the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department issued an opinion saying this is perfectly legal, pointing to lots of instances, most of them before the year 1860, in which the president filled vacant cabinet positions and other what are called principal officer posts with people who had not been Senate confirmed. It is also true on the other side of this ledger that since the Justice Department was created in 1870, we have never had someone who wasn't Senate confirmed as the Attorney General. So in that sense, this is a really startling development. And the state of Maryland has sued already. There are other lawsuits that could be brought. I think that the legal question is really interesting, and there's something deep at stake here, which has to do with, like, do we want someone who's, like, a hand-picked kind of someone who seems to have been chosen to do the bidding of the president to end or screw up an investigation that involves the president and his family, who has not been vetted or confirmed by the Senate. Like, is that a good idea, given how powerful the Justice Department is? I would say, like, no, it is obviously not a good idea. The main purpose of the litigation, though, it seems to me, just because of the timeline, is to pressure Trump into nominating someone to be attorney general who then would go and have to appear before the Senate. That's what we should want here, is the process to unfold in its normal way. And so to me, the most alarming thing thus far is that, partly because of the attention to the elections, this question of, like, okay, how long does Whitaker sit there in this supposedly acting role? And is Trump thinking about nominating him? And if not him, then who? That sort of seems to have, like, slipped out of the headlines. And it's actually really crucial. This is not someone who should be there in the medium to long term in this without Senate confirmation.
Right. Emily, just you made the case, the kind of articulated case for why he's legally allowed to have this job. Can you also quickly articulate the argument about why he is not allowed? Just why those who say he can't have this position say it?
Well, there are two statutory schemes Congress set up. One is specific to the Justice Department. If we were just looking at that statute, Rod Rosenstein would be the Attorney General. So when you have competing statutes, you know, each side can pick the one they want. The constitutional question here has to do with what I was just saying about power and about the role of the Senate in confirming cabinet secretaries. So Justice Clarence Thomas actually wrote a concurrence several years ago saying, hey, wait a second, the Appointments Clause does not provide for people being in these principal officer positions who are not Senate confirmed. Like, we need to really rein that in. And then on the other side, there's this 1898 Supreme Court case, which the facts of it are so far removed from the present that I have trouble taking seriously the notion that, like, this would govern the law. I don't think it does. But what happened was that the United States official in what was then called Siam. Now Thailand, got, like, deathly ill and had to be replaced in an emergency, and the president was able to do that without Senate confirmation. I mean, to me, it seems like if that's what you've got, this 1890 case called Eaton about Siam, like, obviously this is an open question legally, and the Supreme Court could say something else. But it will take too long for the litigation to get to the Supreme Court, and really this is a matter of politics.
And actually, John, before, I know John is champing to say something, but before we get to that, I have one other question, which is, so one of the claims is that he is allowed to be temporarily appointed to this position for 210 days and even longer if there is then a pending nomination. My question is, let's say he's appointed for 210 days. Could the president then appoint someone else for 210 more days? Or does the 210 days encompass the entirety of how long a president can appoint someone temporarily? Is it the person 210 days, or is that temporariness 210 days?
I'm not sure, but that is distressing that we could just have
totally distressing day
periods going on in ad infinitum. I mean, that is like, right. That is not a good idea. Oy.
Go ahead, John.
Well, there's also, so I talked to Senator Kennedy from Louisiana last Friday, who seemed to think that there was going to be a quick appointment. I don't know if his mind has changed. But you should also note that Whitaker holds just outside of – well, I've got 2 points. One is Whitaker holds some really exciting views, like Marbury Madison was wrongfully decided, and therefore there is no judicial review.
Yeah,
and that they're an inferior branch of government.
I'm sympathetic to that guy, but go ahead.
Senator Kennedy said about Marbury Madison, I think you should take another lick at that case. but then the second thing is, Emily, isn't the thing you want to protect that if an attorney general is going to make a determination that affects the executive branch, Congress wants to have some say in choosing who the attorney general is?
Yes.
Is that this kind of because you want basically you want some maintenance of separation of powers to exist in the specific set of issues he might have a hand in.
Right. And also, I think this is a point that Neil Katyal, former Solicitor General, was making. An acting attorney general hasn't been confirmed to the Senate. That person is, like, very much in the sway of the person who appointed him, who is President Trump. Like, effectively, President Trump is directly controlling Whitaker's future employment. And so that right. gets very close to the idea that President Trump is the judge of his own case in the Mueller investigation, if Whitaker is really serious about becoming – about supervising the Mueller investigation, which he does seem to want to do, right? There's this separate fight going on about whether he should recuse himself because of all the, you know, Fox News and CNN commentary he did railing against that investigation. But as long as he is in that role and he doesn't even have the independence that Senate confirmation would provide, effectively, President Trump is at the top of that investigation in a different way than, you know, was already true since he is the leader of the executive branch.
Can I make two points, which are just like really points that someone who time traveled from 1978 and suddenly showed up in America, those were the first points they would make. Number one, it is like just shockingly embarrassing to have this kind of hack, this failed politician, this lawyer for a scam patent company, this guy whose principal qualification for the job is that he went on television and attacked a legal investigation of the president, to be the chief law enforcement official. That's number one. The second one, which is much more unsettling to me, is we're not even talking about the fact that for the president of the United States, the only qualification for who should be the chief law enforcement official of the United States, the only qualification is, how does this person feel about the investigation of me? The entire choice of who sets and administers national legal policy is determined by the president's attitude towards this investigation of him. Jeff Sessions, you know, God love him, I don't, like, was a person who had was tremendously effective at legal policy in ways that served conservative interests, or a lot of conservative interests. And for the president, just threw him over because Sessions didn't jibe with him on this investigation. It's a disgrace that this is the qualification that the president demands. It's appalling. And we don't talk about that enough.
Right. And yet one more time, we have, you know, Republicans in the Senate who have the power of confirmation, who clearly could pressure Trump to quickly nominate someone and have it be someone who has independence and integrity.
Why, John, going to the Senate question, I mean, the president has a Senate, there's a Republican-controlled Senate. There will be a Republican-controlled Senate in January. He cannot possibly make the case that I can't get a nominee through the Senate. There's no case that the country would grind to a halt. You know, someone would face tough questioning from Democrats for sure, but a Republican attorney general candidate will get confirmed if Republicans think he or she is a qualified person. Why are senators not, like, screaming about this? Why don't they care?
Well, because I think they're trying. I think at the moment they're hoping he'll name somebody. Right. So that'll take this problem off their hands, the Whitaker problem off their hands. So, and also, by the way, they've done two things. They've waited for somebody to be nominated, but then also there has been push from Republicans for, and Mitch McConnell just blocked it, but for the statute that protects Mueller. So that's interesting. I would, those voices might grow louder the more days Whitaker is in office. The question is, when the president names an attorney general, even Lindsey Graham, who has been supportive of the president, and particularly on this question, who has basically first said, if you fire Sessions, there will be a revolt, and then basically said, no, Sessions has got to go, has said, you know, the question I would ask the next attorney general is, are you going to let Mueller conduct his investigation and finish it without interference? And that was the threshold question for him. Now, that might change for Lindsey Graham, although he said it relatively recently. But I think it would be the threshold question for people like Tom Tillis and for other Republicans. So I don't think the fact that the president – and if that's the case, then the attorney general who gets nominated, building off of what you said previously, is going to essentially have publicly affirmed the sanctity of the investigation and protection of its final whatever. So that locks that in. So that I can imagine a way in which that actually wouldn't be great for the president. Locking that in, and But I think that would be the result of anybody who gets confirmed would have to lock that in.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of conservatives who could be excellent attorney generals. Like, let's just make that clear. If conservative legal policy is your priority, it's just it is not. There is nothing normal or necessary about this situation with Whitaker. And, you know, one interesting development this week was a small group of conservative lawyers led by George Conway and also John Bellinger III, a former Bush official, started a group that is effectively trying to say, like, we are conservatives, but there are larger principles here than President Trump's policy goals. We should be thinking about the importance of the rule of law and freedom of the press, the independence of the Justice Department. They might want to add voting rights or at least not making baseless claims of cheating elections to their list. And, you know, I think it's another sort of never Trump move. And these are always these like smaller breakaway groups. But it's heartening to see people being willing to put general principles above partisanship.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are, like me, without a freezer, and therefore your vodka is now warm, and so you cannot make your martinis, and thus can only have the beer in your fridge, and so your cocktail is a beer, what will you be chattering about, John Dickerson?
So my cocktail chatter is about a fantastic book of American history. I've learned about it from Joanne Freeman, the Yale professor who most recently wrote The Field of Blood, and I'm a huge fan of hers. But it was a link to another professor, Nick Kapoor, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's a Rutgers professor, historian of Japan and East Asia. And he tweeted this week about an American history book from 1861. And the book starts with George Washington with a bow and arrow next to the goddess of America. Okay, that's fine. Then Christopher Columbus. Okay, that's cool. It looks like, you know, basically it's an American history book with characters that don't look, you know, they look Japanese and not American. But then in the third one, George Washington is suddenly defending his wife, Carol, from a British official named Asura, which is the name of a Buddhist deity. Then Washington's second-in-command, John Adams, battles an enormous snake. Then Washington and his wife, Carol, meet a really young-looking Benjamin Franklin. And it goes on and on. It just gets weirder and weirder. John Adams carrying a cannon. And then finally, my favorite is George Washington, who straight up punches a tiger. These images are all in his Twitter feed. They're great. And then also he says that it's available actually online at a university. And that's also at the end of his long and delightful Twitter stream.
Sounds like the sort of dream version of Whistle Stop.
Yes, exactly. I know we don't have enough punching tigers in Whistle Stop.
Exactly.
Emily, what's your chatter?
We are possibly going to see some important bipartisan compromise in the lame duck session around sentencing reform and prison reform. This is a bill that members of Congress from both parties have been working on, I think, for years. And President Trump just announced his support, which may give enough conservative law and order Republicans cover that they'll actually get these things passed. So kind of related to that is an amazing study that came out this week about what's called holistic defense. So this is legal representation that was pioneered in the Bronx a couple decades ago. And the study is about the way that the Bronx defenders use this kind of defense. Basically, it's social workers being paired with lawyers to try to address the issues in defendants' lives that often have more to do with why they're in court than like anything that's actually happening in the courtroom. So things like housing and mental health and drug abuse. And what is interesting about this study, it's a big study of almost 600,000 cases from 2000 until 2014, UPenn participated in it, and also the Rand Corporation. And they found that defendants who got this holistic model of defense were 16% less likely to go to jail or prison, and they got sentences that were 24% shorter. They were also 9% less likely to be detained pretrial. And it matches what I've seen in court in Brooklyn, where lawyers paired with social workers, I think, can just be really effective in a way that involves solving the problems in people's lives, the problems that led them to get to court, in addition to dealing with the kind of straight up legal questions in front of them. So interesting study. You can read more about it at the Marshall Project, and we can post the link.
All right. My chatter is about a story in Emily's very own New York Times about a highway in Brazil. And it was just it's just a really interesting story about Highway BR-262, which is one of the only, maybe the only road or the main road that cuts through the Pantanal, which is a soggy, naturally wondrous region in Brazil. And this story is about how it is the deadliest road in the world for wildlife. And there's a biologist named Wagner Fischer who's been monitoring and chronicling it and taking photographs of the roadkill for years. And so it's just it's a really sad story about all the caimans and pumas and rare birds that get whacked on this highway. And the reason they end up getting killed is because this highway is sort of like slightly higher than what is sort of kind of the damp, soggy landscape around it and a dry area. And so it's a good place to cross and a good place to walk on. But it's also a place where you're going to get hit by a car because that's where the traffic is also. The point is not that this is the worst tragedy in the world. There's lots of, roadkill is a thing that happens wherever there are cars and trucks. And in fact, the scale of death is not that enormous it doesn't seem like that enormous. You know, it's 1,000 animals dead over the course of a couple of years. But what it points out is that this is all associated, it's all part of this kind of development of this wild region and the farms that go in and the encroachment on indigenous people and the sort of destruction of natural habitat. Collectively, all these different things add up to being a tragedy for the animals there. Anyway, it's got gruesome photos, but it's a really interesting story about Highway BR-262. And of course, we have a listener chatter. Again, excellent listener chatters. Please keep them coming. As you also, please keep conundrums coming. You can tweet at us at Slate Gabfest with your listener chatter or with your conundrum. And you can also send your conundrum to us at gabfest@slate.com. So Drew Thurlow at Drew Thurlow points us to a story about why we're living in the age of the chair. And it's a story which I think was on the BBC. My computer stopped working, so I can't actually click the link, but I remember it was on the BBC, and I think it's from a book that's coming out about the chair, which just points out that chairs are a new phenomenon. Who knew that people didn't really have chairs for a long time, or chairs were only something that the very rich had, and chairs were very uncomfortable in the early days, and chairs are, you can tell they don't exist. They're not mentioned in literature. They're barely in Shakespeare, but by the time you get to kind of the mid-19th century, the chair becomes a common mention. It's a common object in life. This author estimates that there are 60 billion chairs in the world. That seemed high to me, but it's a reasonable guess. It doesn't seem unreasonable. Let me think about my own house. I certainly have like 5 chairs per person in my house. The chair, it turns out, has these massive societal effects, notably on our health. Chairs make us a lot less healthy. And the chair even more than the computer.
So I bet they also help humans convene, right? I mean, we spend longer times talking to each other when we sit down. That's why standing meetings
are short.
That
is a good point. This podcast has been going on forever because we get to sit down.
No, I'm standing up and I need it to be over, actually, because of that. the story, by the way, is in the BBC, and the author of it is named Vibar Cregan-Reed, which is an awesome name.
That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. And again, tweet some chatter at us and tweet some conundrums at us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. John Dickerson, my studio buddy today. I'm Dave Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ever listen to podcasts with your kids? It's a great way to keep them entertained and engage their minds without relying on screens. I want to tell you about a new kids' history podcast hosted by me, Joy Dolo. It's called Forever Ago, and I teamed up with the producers of the award-winning kids' podcast, Brains On, to make it. Forever Ago dives into the amazing backstories of everyday stuff, like emojis, video games, and skateboards. We use games, skits, and kid co-hosts to keep the whole family engaged, while teaching listeners to think critically about history. Along the way, we'll hear some incredible stories, like how a curious teenager revolutionized skateboarding.
Gnarly.
How alarm clocks used to just be people.
Rise and shine.
And how the poop emoji almost didn't happen. You can find Forever Ago on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.